Today is Tuesday, June 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, could the U.S. and Iran be heading closer to confrontation?
Unprovoked attacks on commercial shipping warrant a retaliatory military strike against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
President Trump gets ready to launch his re-election campaign amid less than promising polls. Also ahead, one of the best-selling singers of all time is heading back to Las Vegas. It's all on today's International Edition. Amid escalating tensions with Iran, acting U.S. Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan Monday announced the deployment of about 1,000 more U.S. troops to the Middle East for what he says are defensive purposes. Also Monday, Iran's Atomic Energy Agency said the country would soon surpass the limit on the amount of enriched uranium it's allowed to keep under the 2015 international agreement aimed at restraining its nuclear weapons program. Fears of a confrontation between Iran and the United States have mounted since last Thursday's attacks on two oil tankers, and it comes more than a year after President Trump announced Washington was withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear deal. If Iran follows through with its threat, it would be Tehran's first concrete step in breaking with that agreement. VOA's Latika Hoke reports.
Iran warned last month that it would stop observing restrictions on its stocks of enriched uranium and heavy water agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal unless the remaining signatories of the deal, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, help it circumvent U.S. sanctions to sell its oil. The tensions between Washington and Tehran escalated last week after an attack on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. The United States blames Iran for the attack, which Tehran denies.
Assessment is based on the intelligence, the weapons used, levels of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and of course the fact that no proxy group in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with this high degree of sophistication.
The State Department spokeswoman called Iran's announcement Monday a nuclear extortion and urged the international community not to yield to it. She criticized Iran's behavior in the past 40 years.
They continued to build their missile program. We relieved sanctions. They took American sailors hostage. We have seen no moderating behavior by this regime. And in fact, you know, what we're seeing here, of course, over the past week, is constantly threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz. A number of activities, not just the two commercial shipping vessels that we discussed this week.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the United States will use any means necessary, diplomatic or military, to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. But some lawmakers also blame the administration for the escalation of tensions.
Well, the United States pulled out of the agreement, which would have limited them. It's hard for us to say much now when we're foolish enough to pull out of the agreement.
Israel called for more sanctions on Iran if it breaches the nuclear deal. But Russia came to its defense, saying that international inspectors recently concluded that Iran completely fulfilled its obligations under the international agreement. Britain, Germany, and France warned Iran against violating the 2015 deal.
All forms of escalation do not go in the right direction and won't help Iran itself and the international community. So we will do all we can with our partners to dissuade Iran and find a path to a possible path for dialogue and improvement of these conditions.
Pompeo is meeting with U.S. military officials on Tuesday to discuss possible new deployment of U.S. troops to the Middle East in response to last week's attack on the two oil tankers. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortega said Monday that other nations should not allow Iran to dictate their actions, that after France's president and the European Union weighed in on nuclear concerns.
We, you know, would say to the international community that we should not yield to nuclear extortion by the Iranian regime.
For that part of the story, we're joined by Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what's the view in Europe over what's been happening?
Well, essentially, the French president and the European Union generally is trying to play all this down. It's essentially realizing that this threat by Iran to pass the stockpile limit is an attempt to force the Europeans into upping their game and helping the Iranian economy to get some way back on its feet again. The deal that the Europeans said that they had in place was that they would step in, that they would set up some sort of entity which would allow European companies to trade with Iran, and that would work and that would get around the American sanctions. Now, Iran doesn't feel that's been done quickly enough, and that is why they think, at least here in Europe, that this is just that calculated move. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron, he has said to Iran to please be patient and responsible. That's his way of saying to them, we're trying to get this whole entity up and running. It is not easy. He also said that any kind of escalation at the moment is in nobody's interest. It would damage the interests of the Iranians themselves and also the international community, he said.
It's a tricky situation, I would imagine, for Europe, given the connection to the United States.
They don't seem to give any indication that it is tricky. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said today that anything that the European Union decides on when it comes to the nuclear deal, she said, will be based on statements given by the IAEA, referring to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which regularly reports on the implementation of the accord. She said that for the moment that an IAEA report showing Iran is no longer complying with the deal would be a red line, but they don't have any report like that at the moment. So essentially they're just saying as long as the IAEA confirms Iran keeps to the deal, they will keep supporting that JCPOA agreement.
And what about the pressures that the U.S. has and may ramp up on Europe as far as business with Iran?
That is the problem, really, and that is the crux of the problem at the moment between Europe and Iran. Europe was trying to put into place a sort of a mechanism whereby European companies could get around U.S. sanctions and trade with Iran, but they've since discovered, actually, that so many European countries are so intertwined with American companies that it's becoming really just too complicated. So you could say that this really is nothing that the Europeans can do about it. Having said that, European Union foreign ministers did meet on Monday, did say that they were going to have a look at U.S. claims which have come up as a result of tensions, particularly over those attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf. They said they are going to look at that, but they did also say they're going to continue to gather information. They said that they need to be meticulous and they need to take time. And in fact, it was the German foreign minister who was really quite vocal when he said that everything needs to be treated in a very meticulous manner, and all information needs to be gone over again and again.
So, Catherine, I know here in the United States, people here just really don't have an appetite for going to war with Iran. What about over there? What's the sentiment?
One of the big issues that still remains when it comes to Europe and Europe's place in the world is how the EU reacted to the 2003 Iraq War, when the US and Britain said they had evidence that Saddam Hussein's regime had weapons of mass destruction. Now, they were never found. And since then, a lot of European countries have put in place legislation that has made it a prerequisite, their own intelligence evidence, before giving any green light to any military involvement. So you're looking at the Dutch and Luxembourg, these sorts of countries that say they have to have their own intelligence on these incidents. So there is no appetite for it at the moment, and certainly there is no evidence that there is any need to go towards that. And Luxembourg's foreign minister made it very clear that it would need to have a clear UN mandate that any investigation commission could work on and then could say if there was a risk.
All right, that is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Sudan's Bashir appears in public for the first time since his ouster. Despite the polls, Trump claims he leads 2020 Democratic contenders. The U.S. says Hong Kong protesters demonstrate for basic rights, and Ethiopia plans to privatize key state enterprises. For expanded coverage of these stories and more, find us at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump officially announces his re-election bid in the key battleground state of Florida Tuesday. The launch of Trump's re-election campaign comes amid reports the president's dismissing some of his own internal polling that shows him trailing behind several Democratic White House contenders in several key states ahead of the 2020 race. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports.
Air Force One lands for a recent campaign rally in Pennsylvania, a key battleground state in the 2020 election that President Trump narrowly won in 2016. Trump sees the strong U.S. economy as his number one advantage heading into next year's campaign.
Politics is a crazy world, but when you have the best employment numbers in history, when you have the best unemployment numbers in history, when you have the best economy probably that we've ever had, I don't know, how the hell do you lose this election, right?
A new TV ad by the Trump campaign, released on the eve of his re-election kickoff, reminds voters of his accomplishment.
And we will make America great again. Thank you.
Trump officially launches his re-election bid Tuesday in Florida and appears eager to take on whomever emerges from a crowded field of Democratic presidential contenders.
Vice President Joe Biden.
At the moment, former Vice President Joe Biden is the Democratic frontrunner with a sharp focus on criticizing Trump.
He's a threat, in my view, a threat to our core values. 4 years of Donald Trump will be viewed as an aberration in American history. Eight years will fundamentally change who we are as a nation and how we're viewed around the world.
Recent national and state polls have given Biden and several other Democrats an advantage in theoretical head-to-head matchups with the president. Trump also dismissed his own internal polling that showed him trailing Biden and some of the other Democrats in key states, often by wide margins. Presidential polls this early can be unreliable, according to ABC News contributor Matt Dowd.
As we saw in 2016's polls, and the race can change suddenly, I think the president would be behooved to admit reality and to say he's behind and he hasn't been reaching out enough. But Democrats would also be, it's important for Democrats to understand polls can change suddenly, polls can change, and they don't often indicate where the American public is.
Despite the strong economy, Trump's approval rating is weak by historical standards, and it has remained consistently low for most of his presidency, says Larry Sabato.
If we simply restrict ourselves to public polls, then you could really say nothing's changed. Donald Trump has been in the upper 30s, low to mid 40s in virtually every survey during his entire presidency.
The polling suggests that while Trump has largely kept his political base happy, he will need to find a way to broaden his support if he wants to bolster his chances for 2020. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Health officials in Uganda have mobilized against Ebola after it spread across the border from the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Frontline workers are risking their lives to stop the deadly virus, which has killed 1,400 people in the DRC and two in Uganda. Halima Athumani reports from Kasese.
Businessman Penge Kiss has been importing fish for the last 15 years from Uganda into eastern Congo. But for the last week, Kiss says he's had little choice but to stay in Uganda because of the Ebola outbreak that crossed the border.
Kinshasa, we don't know Ebola, but when you get here at the border, wash hands, wash hands, wash hands. And when I got here, we've worked 3 days. In Congo, there's no business. They say there's Ebola, so we have to sit and wait, and even all the banks are closed.
Motorcycle taxi driver Farouk Ayub says Ebola makes him afraid to enter Congo.
Normally, Congolese are the ones we transport mostly. We get them from Congo and take them to Uganda. But we are scared because of Ebola. So now we ask, we don't know how you can help advise us. How can we protect ourselves against Ebola?
Ugandan businessman Raphael Masereka says he and his colleagues are warning people not to shake hands with merchants from the DRC. Ebola is spread through contact with body fluids. The Uganda Red Cross is in charge of Ebola screening at all official entry points from the DRC. But Red Cross branch manager Natkunda Primrose says the danger is from those who cross the porous border where there is no screening.
So you don't know whether they've been in contact with a person who has Ebola, who has maybe attended a cultural function like burial, or maybe if through that process of trading, if they've managed to touch someone, a victim of Ebola.
Ugandan troops posted along the border have a mandate to check for illegal ammunition, but are not prepared to face, let alone fight Ebola.
They'll be vaccinated if we get where they are. But the only challenge we have in that is the question of follow-up, which we're trying to work on, because once you're given the vaccine, we need to follow you up for some time to ensure that everything is working okay with you, don't have any problem.
The traders along the Uganda-DRC border can only hope the measures are enough to stop Ebola's spread so life can return to business as usual. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Wera, Uganda.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Heiress, artist, fashion designer, and mother of CNN newsman Anderson Cooper, Gloria Vanderbilt, has died at the age of 95 after suffering from stomach cancer. AP Entertainment correspondent Margie Sarzaletta reports.
CNN newsman Anderson Cooper announced the death of his mother, Gloria Vanderbilt, on the air. He says even at 95, anyone who knew her called her the youngest, coolest, and most modern person they knew. Vanderbilt was the great-great-granddaughter of financier Cornelius Vanderbilt. She painted, she acted, she wrote books. Her Gloria Vanderbilt line of denim generated more than $200 million in sales at its peak in 1980. She dated Errol Flynn as a teen and got married at 17, the first of four marriages. She told the AP in 2004 she always feels that something wonderful is going to happen, and it always does. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Two big movies are out in U.S. theaters. One is based on a true story, and one is literally a toy story. Joining us to hear more about them is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, let's start with A Black Man in San Francisco. Sounds like an intriguing title, and it's getting a lot of buzz.
It is from first-time filmmakers and first-time actors, too. So that even makes it more incredible. And it stars an actor named Jimmy Fails, and it's kind of loosely based on his own experiences growing up in the Bay Area, and also his best friend that he grew up with, Jill Talbot, who directed the film. And the movie centered around a lower-income neighborhood that's being pushed out by gentrification. And it's happening all over the country. It's happening in Brooklyn. It's happening in L.A. It's just all these neighborhoods have been around for 100 years or more and rent controlled. You know, billionaire developers are coming in and changing everything. So it's about him wanting to keep in this really nice house that they had at one time when he was a child. And he keeps going by the house. Another couple owns it. And he keeps fixing it up and fixing up the yard and making repairs. And they're like, you don't live here anymore. But he has a dream someday of getting this house back. And when it finally comes up for sale, because the family that lives in it now had a tragedy, he's trying to figure out a way to do something kind of illegal. He's doing squatters. So he moves in furniture, he moves into this house, and he's trying to figure out how to keep it or how to finance it. And there's scenes where he goes to the bank and he's so sincere, and he works in one of those nursing homes. He doesn't make much money. He actually shares a room with one of his best friends in the movie, too. So the movie's about family. It's about identity. It's about gentrification. It's about what's happening to a lot of poor neighborhoods in this country, in these cities, where developers are coming in and changing everything. So it's got an honesty to it. It's got incredible performances and direction. And when you watch this movie, considering that it's a first-time actor and a first-time director, and they wrote the movie together. It won Best Director's Award at Sundance and also an Audience Award. And when I was at Sundance, I didn't have a chance to see it because, you know, it was sold out. But now I saw it. It's like one of my favorite films of the year. So do yourself a favor and see one of the most incredible films of the year, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which has different meanings. When you watch the movie, that title really represents something in the film, too.
And then we've got the Toy Story franchise out with yet another one, Toy Story 4. Can they keep it going? Are they keeping it going? Is it working?
I know we're changing gears here from a serious drama to a Disney film, Pixar. Of course, Buzz and Woody are back. And, you know, these are the originals that started the whole computer phrase with Pixar, made them put them on the map. Tom Hanks is back and Tim Allen is back as Buzz Lightyear. This time they introduced some new characters. And as you know, they grew up with Andy, you know, in all three films. But now Andy, believe it or not, is going off to college. How does that make you feel old, right? even a cartoon kid is going off to college and I feel old. So now the toys are given to a little girl named Bonnie in the family. And now Bonnie, of course, but, you know, Woody's not her favorite toy anymore. She goes to her first day of kindergarten and she makes her own toy from the trash, a spork named Forky. I know. I'm thinking, boy, Pixar is really scraping the bottom of the barrel if they have to create a spork with pipe cleaners and putty for feet and popsicle sticks. But I'm telling you, it is the funniest character. It really is. And we also have Keanu Reeves, who plays Duke Kaboom. You know, it's like those Evel Knievel toys where you used to pull the ripcord and you used to jump things. He plays Duke Kaboom, a Canadian Daredevil toy. And so it's about them trying to find a lost toy. It's the same kind of story that we see in all of them. But it's got so much heart and so much adventure. And it's really great to see this Toy Story gang back together. And my only complaint is there wasn't enough Woody and Buzz together because they kind of have separate stories in this movie. But overall, it's going to be a huge hit and people are going to go crazy for it. The audience I saw it with loved it.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Shania Twain is heading back to Las Vegas. The Queen of Country Pop announced 23 performances on Monday for her Let's Go residency at Zappos Theater at Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino starting December 6th. Twain's first Vegas residency ran from 2012 to 2014, but since then, Sin City has been bombarded with residencies from pop acts like Lady Gaga, Drake, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, Jennifer Lopez, and lots more. Twain, one of the best-selling singers of all time, has the title of creative director for the new residency. She says she wants the audience to party alongside her each and every night. You're still the one I want for life. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. We beat the odds together. I'm glad we didn't listen. Look at what we would be missing. They said, I bet they'll never make it. But just look at us holding on. We're still together, still going strong. Still the one.
I'm so glad we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, much of the development work done by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, centers on the empowerment of women. That's because women are key to economic growth. As we invest in women, and as they invest in their families, we invest in better societies together, said Bonnie Glick, USAID Deputy Administrator. Because one thing that we've learned is that when a woman earns a dollar, she puts 90 cents back into her family. At the 2019 Global Entrepreneurship Summit, USAID and Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC, launched a partnership with Women's World Banking to create the Women's World Banking Asset Management Blended Finance Fund. OPIC is providing $25 million to the fund, while USAID will contribute $500,000 in catalytic funding and $100,000 in technical assistance to the fund. The blended finance approach offers USAID an effective tool to empower women to reach their full economic potential and to create more self-reliant communities, said Deputy Administrator Glick.
Used properly, blended finance channels private capital into areas where it can have a positive impact while generating solid returns. It develops markets and builds local commitment and capacity to plan, finance, and implement solutions to their own development challenges.
The idea behind our engagement here with Women's World Banking is to serve as a catalyst, and that's what blended finance does, said Deputy Administrator Glick. It provides the initial seed capital that allows other investors to come to the table with more zeros at the end of their engagements.
The fund is projected to raise $100 million to expand women's access to financial services. The blended finance vehicle is designed to attract private capital in developing markets by offering protection to commercial investors and lowering the risk of loss. The fund will lead to increased financial inclusion for low-income women in Africa, the Middle East, and the Indo-Pacific region. More women will have access to loans, develop credit, build their savings, and purchase insurance, which are all critical to breaking the poverty cycle and promoting self-reliance.
By investing in women, said Deputy Administrator Glick, USAID is enabling countries to progress beyond assistance by unlocking human potential on a transformational scale.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.